Hi, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Nick Gillespie.
Hi, Andrew.
Catherine Mengu Ward.
Hi there.
And Matt Welch.
Grunt.
And our president, which is Donald Trump's Twitter account, has been stirring up all sorts of emotions across America. Recently, he retweeted a doctored video where Donald, in his WWE days, is beating up a guy, but his face has been replaced by a CNN logo. Catherine, are we living in a parody universe?
I hope so, because that means there's a real universe somewhere that we could perhaps retreat to. No, I actually am not against a universe in which even fancy pants elected figures and judges communicate in memes, as we discussed last week. But the notion that what our president would be using a meme for is to imply that he is literally kicking the shit, well, punching the shit, I guess, out of a news organization does not seem like a great sign for our democracy. I would be totally fine with it if he were metaphorically punching the shit out of, I don't know, Obamacare. But, I don't love the idea of a president saying, I'm going to do violence to the free press. It's funny.
So, Catherine, some of the comments that I've seen from other other pundits and other people in the media is that this is not just a juvenile outcry, but it is a attack on journalism, or at least implies that sort of violence against journalism is okay. You would kind of fall more into that camp of this goes beyond the juvenile into the questionable.
No, I think this is solidly, squarely in the juvenile, for sure. And I do think it's always important, particularly with Trump, to draw a distinction between sort of talking a bunch of shite and actually doing something unconstitutional. I don't think it's a good sign, but I don't actually think that a line has been crossed here that makes me fear for the Republic. I just don't think he's a good president. And this is yet another piece of evidence in that case.
Nick, one of the things that I keep reading is that America's sentiments regarding the presidency seem to be in decline while President Trump is in there. He's not doing terribly well in the polls, and the grandeur of the office seems to be lessening somewhat. Is that bad, or are the loss of credit in American institutions, or is it a good thing because we're, you know, disassembling presidential reverence?
Well, you know, I think the first thing that we have to do is worry about how this is going to affect professional wrestling's status in America. I feel like Trump is dragging professional wrestling down to his level, so I'm a little bit disturbed by that. But beyond that, yeah, there's a couple things to consider. One is that, Trump's approval ratings actually are creeping upwards, which is interesting, while the media tends to be doing very poorly in general. So, there's something about that. And I find Trump a risible character in most ways. I actually like, more than a lot of libertarians I know, I like a lot of his appointments and a couple of his policies that are basically coming out of his appointments. So people who are deregulators at outfits like the EPA, the FDA, and the FCC, That's all well and good. He has talked about an infrastructure plan, which who knows how it will actually shake out, but it actually has real potential to allow the United States to actually not just rebuild crumbling infrastructure, which is typically an overstatement, but actually move us into the 21st century where we're using, a private capital that is widely available around the world to actually build better bridges, better roads, better and more roads and toll roads that will actually allow us to get places more quickly and ultimately cheaper and more efficient, if you believe time is money, redoing bridges, stuff like that. That all remains to be seen. But Trump, his tweeting habits, the stuff that bothers me as much as something like this, because I think CNN, can take care of itself. The weirdness of him taking the time to do this kind of stuff strikes me as a little bit bizarre. And the earlier set of tweets that he had made about Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, and again, like the feint towards Mika having a bad facelift and bleeding from a bad facelift that actually kicked off the weekend before the 4th of July. That, you know, that kind of suck. It's not that I worry too much about it. It's, you know, that isn't the reason why a guy who was a Bernie Sanders supporter actually took a gun and took shots at Republican, you know, congressmen and senators playing, practicing for a charity baseball game. That's not because of Trump. I think Trump reflects something that is going on that is deeply troubling. And I do think it's tied to the complete evacuation of confidence and trust in major institutions. And it's not just political institutions. It's also big business. It's also small business. It's also the Supreme Court is seeing its ratings fall. We are at a place where, you know, the America that we have lived in for at least since the post-war era, I think, is breaking down, and we need something new. We need something different. And our major, the people who run our major institutions are not doing a particularly good job of kind of reinvesting confidence or getting confidence and trust from the American people, because they don't care. They don't act as if they are really interested in serving or in doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is serving customers, serving voters, creating the basic frameworks and structures by which we can get on with our lives and prosper. So I don't know if that quite answers your question, but it's not a good thing when a society loses trust and confidence in its major institutions, public and private and nonprofit or third sector. But it's up to those institutions to win us back. It's not up to, you know, make people who feel like they're getting shit on suddenly, you know, change their wicked, wicked ways.
Matt, when Trump goes off on a tirade like this, I still can't tell whether he's just a fairly terrible person, or if this is actually a calculated media move where there's something he doesn't really want to talk about in the media, so he says some crazy shit to get everybody focused on that. What's your read on Trump? Is this ever strategic?
Why try to figure that out is what I don't understand. Donald Trump has been a vulgar shithead for as long as he has been in American public life. He's a guy who calls up newspapers pretending to be someone else in order to brag about his sexual exploits, including cheating on his own wives. He's just a vulgar shithead. There has been no exception to that rule. There wasn't an exception made for the campaign. There wasn't an exception made for this speech or that speech when he turned more presidential. This is who he is and has been his entire fucking life. You know, there might be some strategy to it. Who knows? But like, I think it's a more interesting question of what do we do with the vulgar shithead paradox? And I think going to Nick's point, there's three things. Nick highlighted, I think, number two of it, which is the probably most difficult one, given the people who are there. That number two is the elite institutions, the same places, the civic institutions, the organs of government, the places where you find the most kind of vociferous anti-Trump revulsion of the likes that I just said, although that's usually in nicer language. Those people need to come into accounting for their own massive failures, ongoing failures to do things like just pass budgets or conduct oversight over Congress, or, you know, maybe stop supporting every Tom, Dick and Harry civil war in the broader Middle East. So that's part of one thing that we do. Another part of one thing we do is that we stop giving bastards more power. So when your team's in power, stop cheering it on. And when your team's out of power, recognize the lessons that you can learn from that. I wish that we'd see more of that right now from the progressive left. But it's this weird thing where you have this monster Hitler as president, and we're like, OK, let's get single payer health insurance. It's just like there's something incongruous about that. And then the third thing, and this speaks to the premise of your question, Heaton, is that we need to look away sometimes. You know, the Ben Shapiro, the former Breitbart rabble rouser columnist who's now become kind of a never Trumper conservative, had a tweet out this morning that I largely agree with, which is that, you know, Donald Trump starts tweeting Friday and Saturday, America you know, responds with a completely understandable shudder of revulsion at an offensive and boorish tweet. And then the media starts talking about how this is a attack on the basic fabric of democracy and the Constitution. And then by the end of this, people, at the end of this sermonizing, people are like, you know what, maybe it wasn't so bad after all, because they're so put off by the media. Part of it is stop fucking looking at the guy. Stop overreacting to a stupid wrestling gif. Just recognize it for what it is, which is super cheap, embarrassing behavior from a president. And hopefully, you know, we'll withstand this. We'll take a couple of victories over there, again, that Nick was nodding to in the kind of deregulatory realm and wherever else. You know, if we get some other Supreme Court nominees that are worth a damn, that'd be nice. But take whatever small victories, but try to survive a period of time in which, you know, people thought it was OK to have the elephant man as president.
Well, can I also just add, though, part of, you know, CNN in particular, and, you know, they ran a story that they retracted and they essentially fired several reporters for running a story that had one anonymous source that turned out not to be true. And that's just recently. There are other instances where the media, which is in a free fall in all sorts of ways, the prestige of the media, the kind of integrity of the media has rightly been called into question because, you know, there is Trump derangement syndrome going on, where whether it's because of an absolute ideological dislike of what Trump seems to stand for, or market pressures where people feel like it's not important to vet stories anymore before going public with them. The over-reliance on anonymous sources, which is rarely a good thing. Sometimes it's a necessary thing, and there's really nothing wrong with anonymous political speech in many ways. If you look back at the Federalist Papers, the United States of America was actually founded upon anonymous political speech in many ways. But it's, you know, the media needs to figure out what it's going to do. Fox News has done something where it's discredited itself with anybody except Trump supporters for the most part. And it wasn't always like that. At various points, Fox News was actually a pretty good critical source of reporting. And you still have people there that are like that. But MSNBC is similarly in the tank for certain interests. CNN, if cable news wants to, you know, be taken seriously, it's got to do more serious work. And that's true of a lot of different parts of the media. So when you get outside of politics, when you look at things like, you know, places like the Catholic Church, when you look at certain businesses, you know, they have not done a good job of regulating themselves or of winning over the public trust in the wake of big and small scandals. This is something, it's easy to talk about Trump and it's easy to kind of pin the blame on him. But it's actually I really think he's the effect of a lot of this stuff, not the cause of a lot of this stuff. And that we're, you know, to the extent that we focus, and in this I agree with Matt, to the extent that we focus on Trump and just kind of keep the conversation going about, oh, what's he going to do next? And, oh, he's so vulgar, or he's got bad taste, or he's got small hands or whatever. We're missing a larger point, which is that we need to rebuild an America that makes sense in the 21st century. And we are relying on these institutions that all came into prominence 50, 60 or more years ago, and they are not up to the task. When you look at a company like Uber, for all of its problems with its, you know, now deposed founder and CEO, Travis Kalanick, they have a system of rating and regulating their drivers and their passengers, and they have gotten, you know, they're clearing out their executive suites. That's a model that might be useful for a lot of other people in a lot of other industries or sectors to be looking towards.
I think, though, that this is something we've said on this podcast before, and it bears repeating. You can be anti-media and anti-Trump. You can be you can say that both of these things are broken in fundamental ways, and you don't really have to say who caused who. I mean, the fact that CNN is running, you know, single anonymous source stories that turn out to be untrue, obviously very bad. The fact that Donald Trump is tweeting about random private citizens in a way that he describes as modern day presidential, and which is in fact just like the lowest of ad hominem, distracting from actual serious policy, is also bad. We can just say they're all bad.
Hey, Catherine, I subscribe to Reason Magazine, which is a fine publication. And a couple of months back, maybe 3 months ago, there was a story that drew parallels between FDR and fireside chats and Trump and Twitter. How close is are we in brand new territory with Trump being this belligerent, constant constant media source, or have we had foreshadowing of this in the past?
So certainly the FDR piece that we ran, I found it enlightening. I always want it to be true that things are not worse than they ever were. I this is my one deep contrarian streak, is I want to say, yeah, people were just the absolute worst in the past, just as much as they are the absolute worst today. And certainly FDR gives Trump a run for his money. There's a bunch of transcripts from his press conferences, which we quoted from in that piece, where he, you know, jokes about imprisoning members of the press and jokes about hiring them so that they won't write bad things about him. The fireside chats were absolutely analogous to Twitter in terms of a president looking to go around the established media in order to talk directly with the people, and frequently to use that platform to subtly or not so subtly slander his opponents. I think in this way, we can absolutely say presidents have always talked smack, and they've always talked smack about the press even. It makes me nervous through all of history, though, right? I mean, I think, you know, the fear that the most powerful person in the country will crack down on the media in some way is a fear that is validated in other nations time and time again, well into the 21st century. And it is a fear that it's always worth keeping in the forefront. But yeah, other presidents have done this too, FDR in particular.
You know what is what, if I can point out, though, what is totally different, and I agree, I think that's a great story in the recent issue of Reason about, you know, the ways in which presidents have always attacked their enemies. The big difference, and this is worth thinking about, because I think Trump is objectively worse in terms of what Matt, I think, aptly called his vulgarity and whatnot. What is different is that the president has, and any politician has, far less control over the media than they used to. It's virtually impossible to shut down a story before it runs, which was possible to do in the past. It is impossible to regulate the media the way that even people like Lyndon Johnson did, using the FCC as a way to kind of shut down all sorts of issues. Groups like organizations like the FCC no longer has the ability really to license the press, at least in terms of broadcast TV and radio, that it used to. Trump is a wildly unpopular president, and that doesn't mean he's illegitimate, but this is a guy who won with he lost the popular vote resoundingly, and he does not, you know, he's yet to crack anything like 50% in approval ratings, whereas Franklin Roosevelt, in all of his elections and throughout his presidency, was wildly popular and so had mass appeal behind him. So it's worth thinking about, as bad as Donald Trump is, and I would actually argue in a lot of ways, and particularly with the ad hominem attacks and kind of the unbalanced nature of it, and also the ubiquity, or maybe not ubiquity, but the speed of Twitter and the reach of Twitter, which is greater than radio programs that you could only hear once or when they were being broadcast, he has far less power to harass the press in meaningful ways. And it's up to us in the media to, you know, speak truth to power, which doesn't just mean speaking truth to Donald Trump. It also means speaking truth to other people in Congress of both parties, as well as to other people in the media and other people in the private sector as well. So in that sense, and Catherine, I share with you a belief that these are always the better time, you know, the best times of all, except for tomorrow. I think that's actually, you can make a pretty plausible case about the power of the politicians or of the press to corral the press are at near or all-time historic lows, and that's a good thing.
And yet, we do see censorship in plenty of modern states, right? I mean, it may not be that you can totally shut down every rumor, that you can really control every outlet, but in China and Russia and many other places, the press is still censorable and controllable with the right levers. And I don't think it's outrageous to think that those levers could be brought to bear in a slightly dystopian future United States.
But let's also, keep in mind that the Supreme Court, again, in its current term as well, has been just adding on to the amount of First Amendment freedom that we have here. It's really a robust recent 20-25 years worth of track record there. So it's important for people to have a little bit of distance. A fucking wrestling video is not an attack on the press in any meaningful way. And the press is protected in just about every meaningful way, except where things overlap with national security and things like that, on which Barack Obama has been demonstrably worse so far than what we've seen from Donald Trump, just because Trump hasn't had enough time to really get going here. But in terms of cracking down on whistleblowers, I mean, Eric fucking Holder, and forgive me, it's just morning, it's Monday, it's hot in New York, I'm grumpy. But to see Eric Holder out there peddling his ass as someone who's going to speak up for the civic institution like the freedom of the press, this guy who signed off on the hundreds of Associated Press journalists being snooped into, it's beyond risible. And for people to immediately forget all of that recent history in which any transparency or free press watchdog group worth its salt that has any credibility at all was vociferous in criticizing the Obama administration and Eric Holder in particular. Trump is bad. And let's keep in mind that there are structures available for bad actors, even those people who, for some reason right now, free press spokesmen are considering to be, good actors just because they're no longer in power.
So we've got a tense state with Trump and the media in the United States, but it's still peaceful in the sense that nobody's lobbing grenades. However, that is not the case in our neighbor to the south in Venezuela. So Venezuela right now is under the leadership of Maduro, who took over from Chavez, and both of them have done just a wonderful job dismantling the economy of that country. You'll see stories every couple of months where they were at one point due to a shortage of food eating zoo animals. I've read some stories about shopkeeps that don't bother counting money anymore because inflation's so rampant, they just weigh piles of it. So it's really, really awful in a country that has more oil than Saudi Arabia. And Maduro is doing poorly in polls and it seems to be looking to consolidate his grip on power by rewriting the Constitution. And this led to last week, among other factors, a supposed coup or coup attempt where a man hijacked a helicopter, flew it over their Supreme Court, launched grenades at it, and claimed that this was part of a revolution to overthrow the evil government. We now know that the person that did this was Oscar Perez, who's a B-movie actor. I guess Chuck Norris would be A-movie, right? We're going to give Chuck Norris A-movie status, but think of a Chuck Norris-type guy trying to launch a coup against the Supreme Court. People aren't sure whether this is a legitimate coup attempt or whether this was a false flag operation, because he managed to hijack a helicopter, managed to launch grenades, didn't kill anybody, and hasn't been apprehended. So it might be Maduro just creating some theater in order to justify cracking down on opponents. Catherine Mega Ward, is this a false flag operation or just further evidence that we are, in fact, living in a parody universe?
First of all, I have no freaking clue, because Venezuela is now basically a black hole of truth and there is no way that we can get real information out of it. But I think, my tendency is generally to always assume incompetence over conspiracy. That's my absolute rule in life. And so that my gut is to say, the idea that they gave this dude a helicopter and a grenade launcher and said, go pretend to attack our institutions of government so that we have a pretext to crack down further than we already have. Right. I mean, that's the piece that doesn't make sense to me, is like Maduro needs a pretext. He needs some kind of excuse. He seems to have absolutely violated every tenet of rule of law, of good governance, of the running of basic economy. It's, this little bit of stagecraft, if that's what it is, seems almost oddly superfluous. On the other hand, maybe this is exactly the kind of theater that Venezuela now goes in for. Things are so bad there, and the humanitarian crisis in particular is so horrific. I certainly find it plausible that this whole thing is meant to be a distraction from that. the piece of it that really kills me, and we've talked about this before on the podcast as well, is the notion that there are people in Venezuela who think that they are suffering because the United States has trade restrictions. The fact that it is still plausible, but you know, that Maduro can say, oh, it's the great Satan refusing to give us medicine, that's why your baby died, and that people believe that because we actually do that to our enemies all the time. That's the piece of it that I think we do have control over, that we could change the United States' reputation in the world and with Venezuelan citizens if we wanted to. And unfortunately, we're not choosing to do that.
Catherine, I'll remind you that our embargo and sanctions on Cuba have led it into the vibrant golf course of liberal democracy that it is today.
Yes, true.
So they work fairly well. Nick, do you think it's false flag? Do you share Catherine's position that conspiracies are unlikely due to incompetence?
I mean, in general, is it a variation on Occam's razor that the simplest explanation is more likely to be true, and that in general it's it's incompetence. Oscar Perez, the attacker, according to the Irish Times and a couple of other sources I read, is a police commander. So he, you know, probably might have had access to a helicopter, et cetera. I think that Catherine is right to focus on, the larger question here is what can the American government, or what can Americans do to help ease a humanitarian disaster, and we know from our various efforts, both in the past in Central America and South America, that regime change is rare, as well as, ongoing efforts throughout various parts of the world, that regime change is not generally something that we either should be doing or know how to execute and hold up in particularly good ways. Really, it's a question, and I think this is for libertarians as well, who tend to see ourselves as citizens of the world and to have, a sense of commonality and fraternity with people who are suffering under horrible despotic governments. What are the things that we can be doing? And it's clear that, American foreign policy in general and trade policy with countries that we're trying to work one way or the other tend to be stupid and completely counter-effective, as you were pointing out in Cuba. And then the question is, what do we do after this? And, this leads to what I think is a major criticism of Donald Trump, that stems from his xenophobia, but he, wants to simultaneously kind of say that America is a beacon in the world. Everybody wants to come here. And then he wants to make sure that we keep people out, even in places like Syria, where we are directly and the Middle East, where we are directly involved in creating more and more instability and refugee flows. I would like to see the United States do everything that it can to help feed people in Venezuela. Particularly through the actions of individual citizens. One of our recent TV videographers, Jim Epstein, a few months ago, did a bunch of stories both in Brazil, where faced with a less obviously kind of criminal government, or rather violent government, probably equally corrupt, a bunch of libertarian-minded students and others were able to bring down a government. It doesn't mean that the new government is all that much better, but he also talked about how in Venezuela, Venezuelans are using things like Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, as well as Amazon delivery services to bring basic staples into the country. I would love to see ways in which we can do more of that in a way that does not prop up a government by giving them foreign aid that then they keep most of to buy guns with, but rather empowers individual citizens to get on with their lives or get on with leaving a country that has gone to the dogs.
Matt, when I read about Venezuela and I go through every step that Maduro has taken or Chavez took, I'm always baffled. They did price control that just ruined money and it caused inflation, and everything they did seemed to be demonstrably bad based on the Cold War and everything else that happened. I get why social democrats exist in Europe. They're this kind of cute welfare state with a market economy. I don't understand how full-blown socialism like they have in Venezuela keeps happening. Is it psychological? Is it did they not get the memo about the Cold War? What do you think's going on?
Dude, that's not socialism, man. You know, they didn't try real socialism.
Right.
If they would have, that, the problem is they didn't try real socialism. Real socialism means that you don't have the cadres. It's bottom up, Heaton, right? So that the workers all enjoy the fruits of the revolution together. It's the deviation from that that caused the suffering.
Careful there, buddy. You're like sitting there in your libertarian glass house talking smack. So
I remember when I was out in D.C. Like 10 years ago or more, working on my McCain book, and I was taking what must have been the predecessor to Airbnb, right? So Craigslist apartment somewhere there. Near Columbia Heights, I think it was, and very nice woman, really nice apartment, and everywhere there is this pristine, like, commemorative plates of Hugo Chavez everywhere. There's candles, there's like a shrine for Hugo Chavez, and this is a woman, you know, who's like a professional, probably works for a public interest law firm, maybe early 30s, and you just start asking yourself, like, what need is he fulfilling in her right now? There always needs to be someone like him. And now that's kind of dissipated because it's very difficult for anyone except for people who say the kind of things that I started off this answer with to pretend that that was a good idea. You used to have the Michael Moores, the Sean Penns of the world talking about how wonderful it is, People the Nation magazine, like this great. There's always this desire to champion the person who's giving the most robust middle finger to the United States, and preferably doing it in a way that is more in the direction towards socialism than, you know, Bernie Sanders would dare attempt. I guess there's just that kind of need to have that ongoing. And it is remarkable that people don't learn from that in any meaningful sense. I mean, to do a little slippery slope here, but kind of a similar psychological thing. Did y'all see that, like, Keith Ellison celebrated Minnesota passing a minimum wage to Minnesota or Minneapolis, a minimum wage to $15 by breaking out in song. There's this weird, stubborn inability for people to learn economic lessons that are all around them. There was recently a really great, you know, a highly praised study of Seattle's minimum wage laws that said, oops, that doesn't work. But people need that to believe that to work, and they will not tolerate hearing voices to the contrary. If you want to flip the script and point it towards people maybe from a different political persuasion, you hear that a lot with the free trade of the median Trump supporter is impervious to data about how trade is overall good for the economy, or that immigration is overall good for a country. It's just striking. And I also think, just listening to all of this, we've allowed a word to be used incorrectly, I think, and that word or a phrase is failed states. Failed states is something that we use actually when there is a complete collapse of authority and different people are trying to carve up pieces of a map country, like Afghanistan, like Syria, like Libya, maybe is the best example now, Somalia. Actually, I think failed states really should describe Venezuela. The state is still in charge, and it is a failure. It is a disaster. It will collapse soon into something more anarchic, more like an open civil war. The authority will finally turn inward on itself, and that should have a different name for that. But a failed state is a state that took over. It was a coherent polity or a coherent government at some point. It made decisions. Those decisions ran it to the ground. Venezuela is a crime scene. It's an absolute crime scene and a failure. And anyone who gave that intellectual support along the way or cheered it along really should look at themselves in the mirror for a good long while and ask, how did I help that person who is now eating a zoo animal?
We had a piece in the print magazine about a year ago by Francisco Toro, who worked for the Caracas Chronicle but had since relocated to Canada because being a journalist in Venezuela a year ago was not a great idea, who also answers the question, why do they keep trying socialism? Why does anyone keep thinking this is a good idea? Basically by describing the power of the propaganda in Venezuela, the idea that when there are breadlines that that's in fact some unnamed opposition working against the working class people by purposely setting up lines in order to create a feeling of panic, even though, of course, there is plenty of bread and no one should be worried. When that kind of story is being told, and at least some percentage of the country is buying it, as of a year ago, when Venezuela was already in very, very dire straits, about 31% of Venezuelans said that they thought Maduro was doing a good job. And this is a country where polling is still pretty legitimate. So the fact that you can convince people, even after a century of failed socialism, even after they are living in the midst of failed socialism, that it's still not the fault of the underlying system, that's powerful. And that's why we keep making this mistake. But Toro describes how people in Venezuela are literally trying to find old books about what happened when Eastern European economies emerged from socialism, because they're trying to figure out a way out. They're trying to look for a template. And the last time that anybody did this was so long ago that the field of scholarship has essentially lapsed. So it's fair of us to say, how are we still making this mistake? But the answer is because people believe things that aren't true.
Can I suggest that the root cause one of the root problems in Venezuela is not so much socialism per se, because it's not a fully socialist economy. The state doesn't own all the means of production, et cetera, like that. It was actually quite a mixed economy. And Chavez, what he did was he nationalized the oil industry in a big way. And there's a tradition there. If we want to be serious about this kind of analysis, we also have to look at the history of Latin America in general, where it was not, it hasn't been socialist paradises trying and failing for hundreds of years at a time. It's been strongmen often abetted by the United States government or other corporate interests, and in Venezuela. And so that, people have a history that they understand, which is one of exploitation and oppression. It gets oversold, and everything, just as in the Middle East, everything bad gets attributed to Israel. Everything bad, including a stretch of bad weather in South America or in Latin America, often is attributed to the United States. And that mentality has to end. But Venezuela suffers from having the black curse, which is that it has so much oil, which for a very long time was a very predictable way of generating a huge amount of money. They did not create an economy that was as diverse and vibrant and as multifaceted as it should be. Chavez took control of the oil industry, and that was seen as a good thing because he was able to spread money around from petrodollars, which, but that market has collapsed in a lot of ways. And after a certain point, if you can only reign through autocracy, people stop working as well. But you also see, variations of this black curse in countries like Nigeria and countries like Saudi Arabia and countries, elsewhere, including even Russia. If Russia did not have the oil and gas reserves that it has, it would be much harder for somebody like Putin, who is a crypto socialist, I guess. I mean, he's a crony capitalist in a lot of ways. But I think, we need a different way of talking about this stuff, because the fact of the matter is that there are only, two or three, if even, actual socialist countries left on the planet. This is a model that has failed. There is something weird and borderline sick in the types of people that Matt and Catherine are describing, of people who want to believe in a savior. But the fact of the matter is, socialism in its 20th century form has been discredited, and very few countries, even very few self-described socialists like Bernie Sanders, are actually calling for a return to kind of classical socialism. And I think in Venezuela, what you see is something that has to do with a country that has one source of income and one source of wealth, and that is able to be taken over and run by a ruling junta or a small cadre or a tribe or as a family, as in Saudi Arabia. And it always leads to bad things, because once it's not even that wealth is concentrated in 0.1% of people, but all of the wealth of a country is concentrated in one industry. And that lays it open to all sorts of abuse of everyday people.
quick add-on, Donald Trump in his Little Havana speech talking about the changes in Cuba policy, which, as we've mentioned before here, were exaggerated how much it was a change from Obama administration policies. But he name-checked Venezuela on a couple of occasions in a way that should be interesting looking forward. He asserted that essentially America will assert its kind of sphere of influence on the Caribbean and in Latin America around us, and fight for and be a champion of freedom in that area in dissimilar ways to its approach as laid out in his Saudi Arabia speech. So I would look on that cautiously. I like, as always, to be sympathetic with the victims of oppression in any country. But if that leads to the type of counterproductive policies that we see that Trump is attempting to engage with in Cuba, if he's going to be doubling down on that in Venezuela, I think that is going to be counterproductive at best.
He's also released statements about North Korea. He met with South Korea's leader last week and said that our strategic patience with North Korea is ending, which seems to be him in part trying to kind of addle the Chinese as we figure out what our trade relations are with them. But nonetheless, there's a little bit of saber rattling going on our end. Matt, do you think anything's going to come of that? So far, when I look at Trump's policies, it seems to be 90% ranting and 10% actual policy that's enacted. Should North Korea worry, and should we worry?
Ranting is actually a pretty deliberate, conscious policy on the part of the Trump administration. I mean, they've all but acknowledged that the both the lobbing of 59 missiles onto an airfield in Syria and the exploding of, I forget what the name of it was, the super bomb in Afghanistan, which happened at right around the same time, the largest ordnance bomb that we have short of nuclear, I think, was all about North Korea. It was an attempt to show people, hey, he may be a little bit crazy over here. Nikki Haley, the ambassador of the United Nations, said this out loud 5 days ago or so, that there is something strategic about the seeming instability or unpredictability of Donald Trump vis-a-vis North Korea. That's always terrifying, of course. You don't really want to inject too much instability in a situation in which kind of the best case scenario for any military conflict that involves North Korea is that 100,000 people in Seoul die. That's not a good thing to happen. On the other hand, we know that China has said a few things that it had never said, or at least hadn't said in 20 years, in terms of we will not accept North Korea to do X and we will impose Y type of restrictions on them if they continue testing missiles, if they continue developing these technologies. So nothing has ever worked with North Korea in terms of U.S. policy, as far as I can reckon, short of that there has not been a murderous military confrontation in the last 40 years. So I guess, knock on wood for that. I'm worried that if you use instability or like unpredictability as a weapon here, I can see how it might work. But the possibilities for it not working and backfiring are pretty terrifying to contemplate. It's just a hard question.
Catherine, do you think that North Korea poses a threat to us?
I would like to think that it doesn't. But this is one place where I actually want to make an argument from authority and say that people who know more about things like the ranges of missiles and exactly who's got which nukes where and what kind seem to universally believe that this is really a threat. I sort of struggled to take North Korea seriously. I think this is Michael Malice's fault. I read his Dear Leader Foe memoir and just sort of can't stop giggling about what is potentially the greatest existential threat on our planet. So that's a problem. But I think the idea that we are walking a line, it's sort of an edge case on whether this is actual self-defense of the United States, defense of the territories within our borders, or whether it's part of the sort of more complicated, interrelated global agreements in which we participate that include North Korea's neighbors who are more likely to actually suffer. I think in some ways that's why we're so obsessed with the North Korea question, because the impulse of the American public when you poll people about this is very different. If you say, okay, well, they might nuke us, they might nuke U.S. property, versus they might nuke their neighbors, or they might cause instability in their own region. People have very different instincts about how we should proceed. And the fact that that distinction is a little bit unclear is what keeps this issue live and hot and confusing in the way that it is. And I think what we're seeing with Trump here, he started out making a bunch of fuss when he first assumed office by taking the quote unquote wrong phone calls from foreign leaders in his early days and generally alarming all of the sage foreign policy types. It seems like the phone calls that he's making, the agreements that he's making with people, are not actually outside of our existing agreements. He just uses more colorful language.
I think that North Korea is a regional threat, and it's one that is best handled by China, and it's a client state of China. China can turn off the last light bulb in North Korea if it chooses to do so. South Korea is a wealthy country that has an army. Japan is also in the area and is, last time I checked, still a first world country. We should be looking at it in terms of that. And it should be up to countries in North Korea's neighborhood dealing with this fundamentally. It's not a country that is going to do very much to the United States or even to our interests in China and whatnot. Australia, New Zealand are also capable of defending themselves. And it's about time that we start thinking about that. I think the North Korea threat and the fact that we maintain a massive military force there, as part of it, it goes to the argument that the more bases we have in the more parts of the world, the more likely we are to get drawn into things. Having said all of that, one of the things that Trump has done, which I think is not getting any credit, and it might be, I don't think he's necessarily a conscious architect of this, but what he's recognized is that China is the rising threat to the United States, and not he sees it in a very dumb way, that they're a threat because they're going to sell us a bunch of cheap shit so that we don't have to spend time making really cheap T-shirts domestically to sell at inflated prices to people, but we can get on with different types of jobs that we can benefit from higher levels of research and technology and education and business practice here. But the fact is that China is a country that has a lot to go through. It is a massive economic power at various points, depending on the year. Its economy, its total economy, is larger than the United States. And I think what we need to at least start to consider is that by Trump cozying up or trying to cozy up to a country like Russia is, in fact, it's kind of a smart strategic move. And he's putting China on the, on the table where it's got to deal with its regional problems. It has a lot of internal problems it has to deal with. It's been making various noises, both towards Taiwan, as always, but also Japan and South Korea and countries in Oceania and whatnot. So, I think that we should be dealing with North Korea in a very different way, which is pushing more and more responsibility onto the countries that actually border it and will, as Matt pointed out, suffer the consequences of a rogue state in its midst. It's up to them to deal with it first and foremost. We can certainly help, but it should not be a fundamental area of concern for us.
Can we talk about this other statement that came out of the meeting with the South Korean president about where Trump essentially conflates the concept of trade deficit with the concept of budget deficit? Because that, to me, in some ways, was the biggest takeaway from these meetings. I can read the quote, which was he's sitting across the table from Moon, and he says, The United States has trade deficits with many, many countries, and we could not allow that to continue with South Korea right now, but we cannot allow that to continue. This is really a statement that I make about all trade. For many, many years, the United States has suffered through massive trade deficits. That's why we have $20 trillion in debt.
Oh, that's why. Oh, okay.
I hope that he's making a sophisticated yet wrong claim about how trade deficits affect our economic growth. I think he's just confused about the distinction between trade deficits and actual budget deficits.
Yeah,
right?
there aren't any sufficient.
And if so,
sufficient meme cats that can explain it that he's been able to look at. So yeah, he doesn't seem to be in great control of the economy there.
There probably is a meme that explains this, though, right? Like, don't you feel like there's somebody out there who's made, like, animated cats that explain this distinction?
All I know is that I have a trade deficit with virtually every merchant that I deal with on a daily basis. And somehow
that's why
I'm
you're $20 trillion in debt.
Nick. I'm able to have some money in the bank at the end of each month, too. So I'm a bit confused by that. Catherine, I mean, this is, to my mind, the stuff that worries me the most about Trump. But there's a silver lining here is that he really doesn't understand, you know, at like a very basic level, he doesn't understand what the hell he's talking about. And he sees that not at all as a barrier to, you know, becoming president, you know, more power to him, and then enacting policies based on his lack of knowledge about stuff. To me, the good thing about all of this is that so far, you know, however many months we're into the Trump presidency, the system of kind of checks and balances is holding. He has been trying to pass a ridiculous and counterproductive ban on travel and refugees from, you know, Muslim majority countries. He's been cock-blocked on that. His skinny budget is not clear that it's going anywhere, although that is, you know, partly because Congress is the one that has to come up with the budget. That's disturbing because, as Matt noted earlier, Congress is absolutely uninterested in actually passing budgets, much less doing it. Even, you know, they can barely agree on continuing resolutions. But what we have seen time and time again is that, you know, whatever Trump is doing, he is being checked by the system. Things are holding so that his dumbest and worst impulses do not necessarily come to fruition. But I think you've pinpointed something here, and it's a pretty big, it's definitely a cause of concern that there's just a lack of conceptual and detailed knowledge about virtually everything he's in charge of.
He's reportedly just railing at his cabinet because he hasn't been able to wave a free trade scalp in the air after getting out of TPP, because even the mechanics of withdrawing from trade agreements or altering them are kind of hellishly complicated. That's why trade agreements are complicated. And this is a shout out to all the libertarians that say all you need for a trade agreement is a single line on a single piece of paper. Okay, good luck doing that. I agree with you. That'd be great. But it's not how it has worked. So unless we go unilateral, we have no more tariffs for anybody, which would be great. You know, go full New Zealand. Let's just do this. In the absence of that, it's complicated. And the Trump administration is discovering that it's complicated. And just on the trade deficit thing, you know, there we have had in modern history in our lifetimes, at least mine, countries that for, you know, a good 10-year span were led by people who said, you know, that's it. I'm going to have no more trade deficits with anybody. We are going to export more. We're going to stop imports. And we are Romania in 1980s. It's a terrible, terrible.
Can sum this up. Always go full New Zealand. Never go full Romania.
I was about to just jump on Etsy and start producing stuff as much as I possibly could to try and limit my personal trade deficit.
But my mind boggles at what kind of Etsy garbage you would produce, Heaton. What in God's name would you like hot glue together and try to sell to America?
You know, I have an idea right off the top of my head. I'm not going to put it in the podcast, but it would involve very tiny Abraham Lincoln top hats. So I've got some ideas, but I'm gonna hold them because I don't want anybody to steal them. And I don't know where Etsy is on patents. So Trump doesn't seem to understand trade deficits. He's having problems. One of his allies is having problems in New Jersey, and that's Chris Christie, who has not really been in the spotlight since the election so much, but appears to actually be in New Jersey, which he wasn't doing at any point during the election. And if you're not in New Jersey, they're having a government shutdown right now, so the state parks and beaches are closed because they've not been able to arrive at a budget. However, this has not affected the Christie family vacation. They are on the beach, or were on the beach this weekend. And when people pointed out that the governor was able to take advantage of a state park, although no other citizens were able to, he responded with, "When I have a choice between sleeping with my family and sleeping alone, I generally like to sleep where my family is," which is a great move. In politics, you answer the question you feel like answering. Don't answer the question you were actually asked. But I think the question is he taking advantage of his office and reaping benefits from it that other people can't do? And should people be irritated? Matt, should Chris Christie be flayed for this? Or is this just the fruits of the spoils of winning an election?
New Jersey as a state should be nuked from orbit, I think, is the main takeaway here. I'm so tired of paying attention to politicians and politics. It's the talking about vulgarity before, this in some ways is more vulgar than anything Trump has done, a little maybe less consequential, of just a huge middle finger to an entire state. The classic "I don't give a fuck." Chris Christie, you wonder about like the culture of places, right? What is the worst political culture in this country? I think I would put three side by side, and I'm not sure which one I think is worse. So you have New Jersey, which has a long tradition of people going straight from either the governorships or various mayoral hoods to prison. And which has you have so much government at every single layer. I have friends who work in local government in New Jersey, and it's horrifying. In fact, Chris Christie arose as a concept to kind of try to peel some of that back. But it's like having someone who's in charge of the Port Authority being for limited government. It just like doesn't make sense structurally. It doesn't make sense. Just like it is structurally to have, hire someone to run the country who's based on living their lives in Manhattan, whether it's Michael Bloomberg or Donald Trump or even Hillary Clinton from her Senate thing is nonsense, because Manhattan is just different than the rest of the country. There's something endemic to the New Jersey structurally, to the New Jersey governing structure that produces Chris Christie's in the world, in addition to whatever foul culture that New Jersey has itself. But the other two I would put are Illinois and Chicago. It's very, very incredibly robust political awfulness. And Arizona doesn't get enough credit. This is sort of a conveyor belt from the state house to the state pen or the federal pokey in Arizona as well. And it'd be interesting to conduct a study. How much of this is like the structure of government? How much of this is sort of endemic cultural things that's hard to measure? But I've just been letting Nick seethe here, so I'd be curious to hear what he has to think about why New Jersey should be nuked from orbit.
And I, of course, that's because I grew up in New Jersey, the finest state in the union. And you can nuke it, but then you're going to have a lot of, poisonous water splashing on all the other states right around it. So Christie is a bad governor. He has Trump-like approval ratings, partly because he did come in on a series of promises that he just failed to keep. He didn't reduce spending. He didn't return autonomy to more local units. He didn't do any of that kind of stuff. And then he had a bunch of really ugly scandals like the Bridgegate stuff going on at his time. New Jersey, like New York and Connecticut, they're among the three richest states in the country, partly because they're around New York City. They are always in the top four of the highest tax states for state and local combined tax burdens. And they refuse, each of them in their own way refuses to change anything substantial. And to the extent that they keep doing that, it's going to be problematic. Christie, just to kind of be a little bit tighter on this story. As governor, he gets the use of a beach home, which is in a state park or adjacent to a state park. That's why he was able to waddle out onto the beach, which was closed because of a government shutdown, because of a budget impasse. It's really bad optics, but you can say that about almost everything that has to do with Christie, and that's not even a fat joke. It's just he comes off poorly in almost every appearance that he makes, when he, either when he is like the hostage in a Donald Trump video, or when he is yelling at people. We have from years ago a great video footage of him yelling at a guy who asked him when he was going to implement medical marijuana legislation that had been passed by the state. The guy's daughter had a form of epilepsy that would have benefited from a non-psychoactive version of pot. And Christie is like, you don't get to make that decision. I get to make that decision. He's a bad guy. New Jersey has had, and somebody like Tom Kane, and even to a degree, Christy Todd Whitman, has had in recent memory, some decent governors, but they're in short supply and probably will be for the foreseeable millennia.
Real quick, Catherine, Nuke, New Jersey, or not Nuke, New Jersey?
I would like to leave that decision in Nick Gillespie's hands. But Nick, I want you to look into your heart and tell me whether or not really, really you think New Jersey should be nuked.
My heart is in an undisclosed location and it's been hiding from me for decades now. So I can't look into my heart. But
Nick, can we pry your heart open just briefly, since we're coming up on the 4th of July tomorrow? Any particular memory that stands out for you about celebrating Independence Day?
Yeah, well, two things. One, first off, New Jersey is known as the crossroads of the American Revolution because more skirmishes, more fighting actually took place in New Jersey than any other state in the country. And the Battle of Monmouth, which kind of puts New Jersey in perspective, which was a draw, but it was it was good enough. It kind of counted as a win for the rebels, for the Americans, and is largely seen as a turning point in the revolution. It was one of Washington's great strategic retreats. But then the other specific municipal or New Jersey government memory for me that sticks out, I worked as a lifeguard for Middletown Township in a place that was called East Keensburg. It is now called North Middletown at a horrible beach called Ideal Beach, which was sandwiched between a sewage treatment plant and a naval or an ammo depot where old shells would kind of pop up out of the water every once in a while and explode underwater. It's directly across from Coney Island. You can see the old parachute jump there. One of our 4th of July's, we used to have fireworks there, and the best one was when city workers or the township workers by mistake lit everything on fire all at the same time, and it just went up, and people were running, screaming from the beach in terror because it seemed like there was some kind of massive attack going on. And I always like to think about that, and it's one of the reasons why I think government has certain definite functions. Lighting off fireworks is probably not one of them.
Catherine, any heartwarming, explosive 4th of July memories?
I grew up inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., so my parents schlepped me to the fireworks on the National Mall every year. And my primary memories are not of glorious explosions in the sky, but of nearly dying on the subway on the way home, because they would like strategically shut down half of the subway entrances and then jam every suburbanite family into the remaining ones at midnight. I have memories as a tiny child of like teetering on the edge of the tracks, certain that this was going to be my final day on Earth. And I'm pretty sure that somehow in there, in one of those moments, was the crucible in which I became a libertarian.
Nice. And Matt,
My favorite
4th of July memory?
My favorite 4th of July memory was when I took a one-way ticket on purpose on that day, because I was that kind of asshole, one-way ticket to Europe. to France at age 21 on the 4th of July. Because screw you, America. But my second favorite was, I want to say it was the bicentennial year, just because, as Nick can testify, that was such an incredibly crappy year in American history that they tried to wrap up in this kind of a great bicentennial pride. And Southern California was super smoggy and had also been engaged in a long and terrible drought, similar to the one that recently ended there. And so I was at a Dodger game, and it might have been 77 here too, but I want to say it's 76 because it feels like it's better. I went to Dodger Stadium on July 4th, which is what you did. And they had the after game fireworks because that's what they did. And of course, there's a drought and there's fireworks and there's a hillside. So the entire hillside caught on fire. And
it was just nature's fireworks.
God, that is the Darwin Awards fireworks right there.
Well, I feel freer and more happy to be an American based on all of these wonderful 4th of July stories you have. And we hope that you listening at home also have a wonderful 4th of July. Nick, Catherine, Matt, I am, as always, smarter and happier for having spoken to you. Thank you for doing the podcast. Thank you for listening. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.